Okay, I'm thinking that more people are coming, and I'm hoping that we fold them in when they arrive. My name is John Beck, and with my colleague Kurt Dewhurst here at the museum, we co-direct our daily work, Our Daily Lives, that looks at the whole intersection of work and culture broadly defined, including labor history. And I'm very fired up about today's presentation, as I'll mention in a moment, but next week, Tom Marvin is coming up from Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, to talk about research he's been doing on the intersection of labor movement and student movements. It's called Occupy the University, Putting Student and Labor Activism in Perspective. I hope that no one thinks when they see the title across campus that I'm asking people to occupy the university, because I'd like to have a longer tenure here if possible. So do take any of those. Like I've told everybody, please put them on your refrigerator. Give them to friends, wrap fish in them. We also have a number of presentations, one of the musically inclined, coming up in November and December. Actually, November, three of them in November, none in December. So please do take the rest of the season and take that with you. Coming up in a few weeks is the East Lansing Film Festival. There will actually be four labor films shown in the film festival this year. Specifically, they'll be showing 1913 Massacre, which is a film made by Louis Galdery and Ken Ross, filmmakers in New York, about the Woody Guthrie song, as well as the event that created the song, which is the 1913 Christmas Eve disaster, where a false cry of fire resulted in the death of 59 children and another 16 adults when they crowded a stairway in Calumet up in the Upper Peninsula. But they're also showing Sasha Ruther's Brothers on the Line, about the Ruther brothers and the rise of the UAW, and two other films. The film that was just shown a few weeks back about Janesville, Wisconsin, they're also showing, which is about the plant closing in Janesville. So I'm very, very happy today. We, through a partnership with the North American Labor History Conference in Detroit, we were lucky enough to be able to bring Joe McCartan to campus. Joe is a professor at Georgetown University in their history department, and is just an unbelievably wonderful historian. His book, which he's talking about today, Collision Course, Ronald Reagan, the Air Traffic Controllers, and the Strike That Changed America, reads like a novel, and even though you already know the outcome, because we know that history, it does have that wonderful kind of narrative tension that really brings the reader to it again and again and again, with a great amount of resolve and fresh eyes for the next chapter, because it really is a riveting read. As Joe and I talked about earlier today, on the way here from Detroit, prior to coming here, was the National Director of Education Research for the Paper Workers Union. So I actually lived through the concession 80s at the helm of a lot of different corporate campaigns and other things that we were running in the union, which he, by the way, mentions in the book in terms of the aftermath of the strike and its effect on the private sector. The PATCO strike was a major watershed for many of us in the labor movement. For the younger ones, they don't really understand what a major watershed it was if they did not live through it, because they don't know what the prior was. And therefore, they don't know, you know, that what they're living through is not the new normal, as it's often been called, but that there used to be a normal that was a lot different in terms of people actually bargaining in good faith and not necessarily replacing strikers. But it's a great book. Joe is a gifted historian, and his students and colleagues are lucky at Georgetown to have him on their campus, and I think we're extremely lucky today to have him here in the Brown Bag Series. So unfortunately, Joe, you're putting up with the carillon, which is always, you know, one of those things that we run into from time to time with this lecture series. So with bell accompaniment, Dr. Joe McCartan, please welcome him to the Brown Bag Series.
Pull this over a little bit. First, I want to thank John very much for inviting me to come here. I'm sorry I wasn't here last time, though, because I understand there was cake. But But still, he's really been so kind. He drove up to Detroit this morning to pick me up and gave me an amazing tour of this campus, which I haven't been on before and was just completely impressed by. And learned that we share a lot in common. In fact, we were both at the beginning of our careers as organizers working for a group called ACORN, the community organization, and even knew some people in common. So it's really a pleasure to be here in his home and to be part of this really beautiful series that he's put on. I also want to thank one of our attendees today, Rick Long, who's here and who brought me a t-shirt, Remember Patco. Rick, and this happens just about everywhere I go in this country to talk about this book, Rick was a Patco striker at Detroit Airport. So when we get to the discussion section, Rick, I hope you'll join with me and kind of share your thoughts and memories and offer your own thinking on what happened.
We totally can't correct
him, did you? It's all right. I'm used to dealing with these controller guys. They are people who are very detail-oriented, and they like things to be just right, as you would want for people who are charged with the responsibility they're charged with. So it's a pleasure to have him here and to have all of you. Thanks for letting me share your lunch hour with you. So, few labor conflicts in all of American history have cast as long a shadow as the one that erupted on August 3rd, 1981. It's on that day, of course, that 12,000 people, roughly, employees of the Federal Aviation Administration and members of the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization walked out on strike, creating a standoff with Republican President Ronald Reagan still in the first months of his presidency. Just 4 hours into that strike, Reagan strode into the Rose Garden, and Rick remembers this well, of course, but probably many of you remember this if you were old enough. He walked into the Rose Garden and delivered a chilling ultimatum. If the strikers did not return to work in 48 hours, he said, they would be replaced. He used the word terminated and replaced. And when more than 11,400 of them refused to heed Reagan's warning, that's exactly what happened, as we know. They were fired, and they were permanently replaced. Only a few labor conflicts in American history did as much to set the tone for labor relations in the period after those conflicts as the Patco strike. Maybe the Pullman strike in the 1890s or the Homestead strike back then had that effect. Maybe the Flint sit-down strike in 1937 also had an effect that could be measured years later. But even 30 years after those historic events, they had really begun to recede from the popular memory. But that hasn't been the case for the Patco strike. Just recently, we've seen it evoked in all kinds of ways. Just a little bit more than a year ago, back on February 7, 2011, as he was preparing to go to his legislature with a bill that would strip collective bargaining rights from most public employees in his state, the Republican governor of Wisconsin, Scott Walker, called his staff together for what he called a kind of last hurrah before we drop the bomb. We know what he did then, because he recounted all of this, you might remember, over the phone to somebody who was posing to be one of the Koch brothers, one of his major funders. And he told this undercover person exactly what he told his staff. He said that after the dinner that night, he pulled out a picture of Ronald Reagan. And he showed that to his staff, and he gave a speech urging them to gird for battle. You know, this might seem melodramatic, Walker said, but 30 years ago, Ronald Reagan, whose 100th birthday we've just celebrated, had one of the most defining moments of his political career, not just his presidency, when he fired the air traffic controllers. Reagan's stand had changed the course of history Walker told his staff. And now it was time to follow Reagan's example. And Walker made clear that he would not accept the offer of the unions that was then on the table. The unions in his state were offering monetary concessions to deal with the deficit problem. But he wasn't interested in negotiating. In fact, he said, "I'm not negotiating. This is our moment. This is our time to change the course of history." So that was Scott Walker just in 2011. A little bit more than a year ago, last September of 2011, when he was still seriously thinking about a run for the presidency, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie went to the Ronald Reagan Library to deliver a speech. It was kind of a tryout speech, you might say, in which he was supposed to lay out his foreign policy ideas. But curiously, this speech, which Christie gave at the Reagan Library, made no mention of the key foreign policy issues that were then afoot. Iraq, Afghanistan, the Arab Spring that had already begun to transform the Middle East. He didn't talk about any of that. What he did talk about, what he used as the framing device for his speech, what he introduced his discussion with, was a reference to the PATCO strike. Everybody in this room and in countless other rooms across this great country has his favorite Reagan story, said Christie. For me, that story happened 30 years ago in August 1981. The firing of the controllers, Chris Christie said, was one of the country's great moments. For me, I cite this incident not as a parable of labor relations, Christie said, but as a parable of principle. It showed that when Reagan spoke, he meant what he said. Ronald Reagan was a man who meant what he said, said Christie, and implying that he would be the same kind of leader. It's no surprise that Reagan's busting of PATCO has been such a touchstone for anti-union conservatives like Walker and Christie in recent years. During the last couple of years, as attacks on public sector workers heated up, talk of PATCO excited anti-unionists with a memory that was really galvanizing for them. And it seemed like each of them, Walker, Christie, and you could add others to that. In Ohio, Rick Kasich got behind a bill to try to strip collective bargaining rights there. And it happened elsewhere around the country. It seemed like each one of them was vying to show that they were more Reagan-esque than the other. But none seemed to play that role more to the hilt than Scott Walker. Just this past June 5th, there was a recall vote in Wisconsin that the unions had helped to put on the ballot because of what Walker had done with his repeal of collective bargaining in the state. As Walker was rallying his supporters to go out that day and basically keep him in office, again, he evoked Reagan and the memory of the PATCO strike. At 3 o'clock that afternoon, Walker, who'd taken to Twitter, as many politicians seem to have done in recent years, sent out a tweet. "President Reagan died on June 5th, 2004, he reminded his followers. Let's win one for the Gipper. And as we know, that's what happened last June. The effort to recall Walker fell short. Walker retained his office. And by doing that, he sort of emerged in some ways as kind of Reagan's true heir. If you watch the Republican convention just at the end of August, he got the largest and loudest ovations of anybody there. And in part, I think it really revolved around the extent to which he had aligned himself with what people had in that convention had come to believe Reagan represented, a kind of toughness, especially a willingness to draw the line with unions. The way politicians like Walker continue to evoke Reagan's busting of PATCO more than 30 years later, I think, says a lot about its lasting impact on our consciousness and our politics. But as the examples of Walker and Christie that I have just shared also show, the event that they try to evoke, the PATCO strike, really remains shrouded in a lot of mythology. And much of it's been consciously manufactured by people like Walker and Christie, who are trying to portray a version of events that happened 31 years ago that in the end is not quite accurate. There are two myths, especially, that these figures have tried to promote over the years about the PATCO strike. The first is the myth that that strike was the logical result of the mistaken introduction of collective bargaining into government, which, once it was introduced, only encouraged greedy government employees to begin to use their leverage and ultimately to overreach, as in the PATCO situation, using their strategic place within the economy to, in effect, blackmail the public to win cushy benefits at taxpayer expense, benefits that many in the private sector did not have, and to do all of that with the help of feckless liberals whose failure to stand up to these unions only encouraged them into their militancy. It was the belief in this view that what Reagan had done is stand up against that big mistake that led the conservative columnist George Will to applaud Reagan for ending what he saw as an era of liberal permissiveness that went back to the 60s. In a sense, Will wrote, the 60s ended in August 1981. So that's one version of how the PATCO strike has been portrayed and explained. And it's the version that people like Christie and Walker have really helped to emphasize in public consciousness. But there's a second myth that still retains a lot of hold on the public memory about this strike. And that is that Ronald Reagan entered office, elected in 1980 and then sworn in 1981, determined to go after the labor movement and specifically public sector unions and to put them in their place. And according to some people who really buy into this myth, Reagan was like a stern sheriff who rode into town determined to restore order. There are liberals and pro-unionists who share a version of this myth that even goes so far as to hold that it was all a plot, that Reagan sort of tricked PATCO into a strike in order to very publicly break this union and thereby to open up an open season on unions across America in the 1980s. I have to say that when I began researching this book, I sort of wondered about that myself. It seemed like if it had not been a plan, it certainly couldn't have been a better plan for how to sort of publicly take on the union movement and hurt it very badly. But as I researched the book that John alluded to, Collision Course, Ronald Reagan, the Air Traffic Controllers, and the Strike That Changed America, I came to the conclusion that neither of these myths hold all that much weight, and that only when we strip away the myths and really come to terms with what really happened in 1981 can we really draw the proper conclusions from that. What I found was not either of these variant of myth that I alluded to, but instead the story of a strike that I think did not have to happen, but one that was made more likely by deep flaws in the system of labor relations that governed the federal workplaces, and a failure of leadership really across the board in both political parties, neither of which came to terms with this flawed federal relations system over a period of 20 years, really, and who, in effect, were negligent in coming to terms with the needs of vital federal workers who ended up going on strike in 1981. The strike that finally erupted on August 3rd, 1981, I argue in this book, really was about 20 years in the making. Its roots stretched back to the years before 1962, when John F. Kennedy introduced a limited form of collective bargaining to the federal government through an executive order. It was called Executive Order 10988. One might say that the spark that ultimately led to the Patco-Reagan confrontation in 1981 had first been struck way back in December 1960 in a scene that I recount at the beginning of this book. One of the worst air disasters in American history occurred on December 16, 1960 in the skies over New York when two passenger planes collided, killing 134 people, everyone on both planes and people on the ground. One of those planes came down in the streets of Brooklyn. That event didn't come out of nowhere. Air traffic controllers who were working in the system in the years before that event consistently were warning their supervisors that they were working with outdated and obsolete equipment, that the introduction of jet travel, which was still pretty new at that time, was shrinking the margin of error to keep aircraft apart, and that there were real systemic problems in how air traffic control was run. What happened was that those warnings were ignored. That terrible tragedy happened. And it was really among the controllers working in New York on that day that the seed for an idea for building a union of air traffic controllers was born. I talk about two particular figures, Jack Maher and Mike Rock, both of whom worked in a place called Hangar 11 in then Idlewild Airport, you know it as JFK today. And it was in an old dusty hangar that they were huddled over really aging radar screens, some of them taken off battleships, and they were trying to govern the air traffic system of the busiest air traffic system in the world in one of the busiest locations, metropolitan New York. Maher had actually handled one of those planes before handing it off to a group of other controllers before the collision, and the whole thing scarred him very badly, as it did Rock and as it did anybody who was working in that environment. Coming out of that experience, what they decided to do was to try to organize so that they could win a safer system for themselves and for the people who traveled. They began what became a long odyssey to try to bring about an organization. And it was a difficult process. They first believed and trusted that FAA management would work with them, but they found that management was more concerned with covering up flaws in the system because it felt it made them look bad than they were in really coming to terms with that. They tried to work through an organization called the Air Traffic Control Association, but that included management people as well as controllers and its membership, and the management people frustrated the use of that organization to try to change anything. Then came Kennedy's executive order in January 1962, allowing federal workers to collectively bargain. And they said, aha, now we have a lever to really change and improve this system. And they began to slowly build a union. It still took them 6 years to do that because the FAA constantly resisted this effort and used all kinds of delay tactics to frustrate the formation of a controllers organization. But finally, one was founded in January of 1968. That organization probably wouldn't have come into being, as I point out in the book, without the help of one of America's most famous lawyer personalities of that time, F. Lee Bailey, who was also an amateur pilot. He was known to the public at that time for defending people accused of murders. He was a renowned courtroom lawyer. But he had also flown around the country in his Learjet and seen how unstable the system was. And when controllers were looking for somebody who could speak out for them, he lent a hand. Over the course of time, between 1968 and 1970, they built an organization of air traffic controllers. And just to understand how that system works, in each control tower of the country, of course, air traffic controllers are working in that tower. Down below that tower, there's usually a radar room where they're also working on entry and departure from that area. And then all around the country, there are facilities known as air traffic control centers in which hundreds of people work. over radar screens, governing the movement from one region of the country of aircraft to another. Slowly, they built an organization that included people from across all these kinds of facilities. But again, each step of the way, they found that the government was sort of resisting what they were trying to do. And they discovered through a process of really of trial and error that only direct action really got the attention of government people. In the summer of 1968, they staged their first direct action. They operated what was called a slowdown. They called it Operation Air Safety because what they wanted to emphasize to the public was that there are not enough controllers to do the job correctly. In fact, hiring had been slowed by the demands of spending for the Vietnam War, among other things. We need to hire more controllers. We need to improve the system. This slowdown really got the attention of the government for the first time, and only by doing that did these people win their first meeting with the head of the FAA. They probably wouldn't have gotten that meeting if they didn't engage in a concerted action to slow down air traffic. The FAA made them promises in 1968. The promises weren't kept. So in 1969, they staged a sick out. Again, federal workers under Kennedy's law or rule had the right to join a union and to bargain, but they didn't have the right to strike or engage in direct actions. So that's why the slowdown was tried. And that's why when the promises were broken there, they tried calling in sick en masse in 1969 to see if that would work. Again, that didn't gain them what they wanted. And so they staged an even bigger sick out, as it was called, in 1970. About 3,000 controllers stayed out for almost 3 weeks. Some of you who are old enough might remember that it was in March of 1970 that the country also saw its first major postal strike. And the PATCO strike, or sick out, happened shortly right on its heels. Now, the government didn't cave into or even meet with PATCO during this to meet their demands during that sick out. And instead, what happened was that the sick out basically fell apart after 3 weeks. The FAA decided that it would fire everybody who was involved in the leadership of that event because it was an illegal, concerted work stoppage, in effect. But then, as I point out in the book, after time and worried about his re-election in 1972, Richard Nixon was engaged in a concerted effort to reach out to the labor movement to try to win over a group of conservative labor people who would later be called the Reagan Democrats. He was sort of ahead of Reagan and trying to see if he could win some slice of the union vote. He ended up doing that pretty successfully in 1972, and as part of that effort, he made a backroom deal with the PATCO sick out leaders who'd been fired. They were all rehired. And not only were they rehired, but the Nixon administration began to finally negotiate with PATCO, and its first contract was signed in 1973. All of that taught the controllers something. We can't make any progress unless we stand together, unless we even show a willingness to defy the law. And you know what? When we do stand together, we can win things. We can win improvements. And real improvements did come in those first contracts in 1973. But over the course of the 1970s, what I point out in this book is that the flaws of this whole federal labor relations system started to show themselves. PATCO had three subsequent negotiations with the federal government. Each one was more disappointing than the last, because governing those negotiations was an essential principle. The Kennedy executive order, and then later in 1978, a law that finally replaced the executive order, Civil Service Reform Act, it was called. Under neither regime were federal workers allowed to negotiate over the things that most workers would feel like are the basics. You could not negotiate over your salary. You could not negotiate over the length of your work week. You could not negotiate over your benefits. They were all non-negotiable in the federal system. Over the course of the 1970s, air traffic controllers really started to chafe at the limits of all of this. Because like all American workers in the 70s, they were coming to see a real problem emerging for them. Anybody old enough to remember the 70s will find this familiar, and others of you may have read about it. But between 1974 and 1980, a vicious wave of inflation swept across this country, double-digit inflation that cut into the real earnings of working Americans and really hurt families. Consider federal workers and their families. They did not have automatic cost of living adjustments like even, say, auto workers had won in their contracts. Instead, their wages were set each year by a political process between the Congress and the president and a group of the president's advisors like the director of the Office of Personnel Management. In only one of the 6 years between 1974 and 1980 did the wage increase of federal workers keep up with inflation. Every year, otherwise, federal workers were seeing themselves fall further behind. There was a growing sense of frustration. And also, you have to know that in the 1970s, the air traffic control workforce was changing. There was a new generation of people who were doing this work. What was characteristic of them was also characteristic of their predecessors. Most people came into air traffic control in the 60s and 70s, having first been in the military and having learned to direct traffic as military air traffic controllers. But the ones who entered in the 70s had a different military experience than the people who entered, say, in the early 60s, because they'd lived through Vietnam. They'd lived through the 60s. And as so many of the controllers I interviewed who took part in the 1981 strike, that Vietnam experience was really formative for them, because it led them to suspect that the government they were dealing with was not honest. It also led them to feel that they had not been fairly dealt with. They had gone over, most air traffic controllers did not get drafted, they enlisted. They had willingly gone to Vietnam, they'd come back, they'd found that their service wasn't really honored, and in fact, they were now working in federal jobs that were leaving them falling further and further behind. By the time they ultimately began to get ready for their 1981 negotiation, a spirit had taken hold within the union that we are not going to continue to play by the rules, which push us further behind every year. It's time to change the rules. And if Congress won't change them, we'll have to use the methods we have used before successfully. We'll have to stick together, and we'll have to bring change by acting. The spirit was so strong that it ended up sweeping out of office the president of PATCO for 10 years between 1970 and 1980, named John Layden, and brought in his place a successor named Robert Poli. Robert Poli was much more aligned than Layden was with the fighting spirit that was emerging within the union, and he led the union into its negotiation in 1981. Just before that, though, came the 1980 election. And what some of you may remember, but others may have forgotten, is that PATCO ended up endorsing Ronald Reagan for president in 1980. And why they did that, I think, is important for us to understand. After dealing with Jimmy Carter for 4 years and going through a negotiation with the Carter administration, PATCO people really felt that they were not going to get a fair deal from Carter. Carter was much more concerned about showing to the center voters of the country that he was not beholden to the labor movement, that he would not cave in to their demands, and that, in fact, he would be tough in his negotiations. Reagan, on the other hand, in 1980, had a different agenda. He was looking strategically for certain groups of voters to send a kind of signal. And one of the signals he was determined to send is, if you elect me, I'm not going to be a crazy anti-unionist who's going to wipe out the labor movement, as some people say of me. Remember, I was once a head of a union, the Screen Actors Guild. And so Patco and Reagan built a negotiation, not with Reagan directly, but one of his top aides. And the union felt like it got a promise that in the negotiations of 1981, Reagan would do what he could for the controllers. Now, that promise was always vague. Right, and in retrospect, you can say controllers read way too much into it. But they were perhaps so desperate for action that they were prepared to believe that Reagan would go much further than he ultimately did go. What happened when they started to negotiate in 1981 was kind of surprising, though. The union had built up and prepared within itself its membership to be able to strike if need be, believing that, you know, we know what we're trying to do. We want to shorten the work week and increase pay, for example, we're not allowed to do under law. They're probably not going to put those things on the table unless we show them we're ready to strike. That's the only thing that's going to really break us out of the confines of the federal system. And so the union prepared itself really well. It set a strike date of June 22nd, 1981. And what happened was that as the negotiation neared, Patco found that the Reagan administration kind of blinked, in effect. Internal documents within the White House show that the then head of the Transportation Department, Drew Lewis, saw the possibility of a strike as a devastating thing that the country needed to avoid. Moreover, he really felt the controllers were asking for some reasonable things. He went to Ed Meese and to others in the White House. He made a case, we have to at least go some part of the way over that traditional line that says we can't negotiate over wages. We've got to do something for these people. Meese gave him the okay. Reagan ultimately approved it all. And what actually happened is that the administration came to the negotiation in its final phase and offered Patco what amounted to an 11.4% increase in total compensation. Now, to us today, you would sort of say, wow, because we're used to hearing if somebody can get a 2% increase, that's a victory. And in some ways, it was really an amazing victory for the controllers that they got that kind of increase. And in this year, federal workers as a whole were scheduled to get about 6%. So they were going to get more than any other federal worker. The problem, though, was that inflation in 1981 was about 10.4%. So most federal workers were going to see a pay cut that year, in effect. And Patco, after all of the trouble that they went through, all of the struggle, after a decade of frustration, after getting ready to push this thing finally over the line, found that in the end all they got was 1%. And so for them, that felt like a severe defeat, in effect. And when the union was in its final hours of negotiation that night, a strike vote was called. The union had in advance said that we'll only go out on strike if 80% of our members, or in fact of all air traffic controllers, support this walkout. But they couldn't quite get that 80% that night. They agreed to shake hands then on this tentative offer. But in the days and weeks that followed, the agreement of this, in effect, 1% increase over inflation, support for that idea began to collapse within the union. That is, support for the idea that we should accept this. The union decided, no, we need to go back to the bargaining table. And they voted down the proposal, or the tentative agreement, and they set a new strike date, August 3rd, 1981. And they went out on strike. The theory then was that, and this is basically the way it was told to me by people who were involved in the negotiations, we'll never know what we can really get from the federal government until we show them we can shut down this system. And so they believed that a strike was necessary to be able to see what they could fairly get from the government, in their view. One of the West Coast leaders of PATCO likened it to what it must have been like to be flying on the Enola Gay on August 5th, I think it was, or of 1945, when it dropped the first atomic bomb. He said to his people, "This will be like being on the Enola Gay. You're going to drop a bomb. It's going to shake the airplane. It's going to shake the world. We don't know how powerful it is. We don't know what we've got until we drop it." And so with that view, the Union dropped their bomb on August 3rd, 1981. Now, the myth is that they did this because they were greedy, because there never should have been collective bargaining in the federal government to begin with. That's the myth that would later grip the public mind. But as I hope you can see from what I've just recounted and what I think I show in great detail in the book, was that this was not something produced by greed. This was not something produced by the introduction of collective bargaining in the federal government. This was produced by, number one, frustration at the inability of the very limited and, as a controller saw it, very broken way in which federal collective bargaining worked that led to this catastrophe. A lot of people had pointed out years earlier that something like this could happen. In fact, the director of staff for the effort to draft John Kennedy's executive order in 1982 was a person whose name might be familiar to you. He was a young Labor Department bureaucrat named Daniel Patrick Moynihan. And Moynihan said, "We cannot have a system that does not allow people to bargain over some essential things and does not provide an outside arbitration option and at the same time takes the right to collective action away from them. That's a recipe for disaster." It took like 20 years almost for the prophecy of those words to be fully understood. So that myth, I think, is dead wrong. But so is the other myth, and that's the myth about Ronald Reagan as an all-out anti-unionist who was determined to break PATCO. The myth that also people like Scott Walker have willingly embraced because that's what they've tried to do, is bust and rip up labor unions. But that's really not what I found in this story. In fact, as I just recounted, the Reagan negotiation in 1981 was groundbreaking in what was offered to PATCO in ways that people who call themselves Reaganites today would probably be embarrassed by. They would call Ronald Reagan an absolute sort of captive of the unions, that Reagan went as far as he did in that negotiation. Now, let me just say a couple of words about that and why this myth is really a dangerous one that persists about Reagan to this day. And that is that we should not forget that Ronald Reagan, though he comes down to us in memory as somebody who was an anti-unionist, never really embraced that view himself. He was a champion in some ways of collective bargaining even when he was president. The recent director of the NLRB, Wilma Liebman, sent me a note about a year ago with a copy of the letter Ronald Reagan wrote to the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, on the 50th anniversary of its founding. So in 1985, Reagan wrote this letter, and it was all about how important collective bargaining is in a democratic society. I don't think you'd find Scott Walker writing a letter like that today, or Chris Christie, or a lot of those people. Reagan's particular view of unions, in fact, very different from what you now see among conservatives in his own party. In fact, he was far more moderate than some of these folks. So what was he about in 1981? On the one hand, he was a former union leader. He never disowned that past. He embraced it. He said that it was at the bargaining table, and he led the first strike that SAG engaged in. It was at the bargaining table that he really learned the skills he would employ with people like Gorbachev later. how to sit down in a hard-nosed negotiation with somebody. He was kind of proud of that. When he was elected in 1980, he was searching out certain strands of the labor movement to ally with. That's what led to the negotiation with PATCO. And he really believed, and his political people believed, that there was a segment of the union movement that could be brought into the Republican coalition. But you couldn't bring it in if you were portrayed as a union buster. Reagan didn't want to be portrayed that way. And that was, I think, partly determinative when he had his discussions with Meese and Drew Lewis about, okay, it's never been done before, but we'll go over the line and we'll negotiate with PATCO over things that no previous administration has done. Because we want to show that we have good faith with some in the labor movement and community. We're not, quote unquote, anti-labor. That was the approach that was underlying Reagan in 1981. It was partly self-interest, it was partly political, but it was partly out of something which is quite genuine for Reagan. He was not the all-out anti-unionist that we would come to remember him as. Why do we remember him that way? I think because what then unfolded. When the PATCO air traffic controllers rejected his offer in the tentative contract that was offered in June, and they did go out on strike on August 3rd, 1981, for Reagan that was all a different ballgame. From that moment on, this was not a labor negotiation, he believed. This was not a negotiation anymore. This was a contest to see who's more powerful, the federal government or a union, the president of the United States or, you know, a union of federal employees. And in that kind of contest, Reagan was prepared to take no prisoners and, in fact, be quite ruthless. And so he wanted to actually issue an order that said, if you don't return to work immediately, you're fired permanently. His staff restrained them, and they decided on a 48-hour deadline. You got to give people time to decide, some of the staff people said. Reagan went along with that. They ultimately defied his order, as we see. And I think then history began to change. Now, I have argued, and I will say this again here, that the most important act Reagan did, and the one that really changed America, was not the ultimatum that he gave on August 3rd. It's what he decided months later. Because about 3 or 4 months into this strike, it was clear he had broken this union. The public in the main had supported it. But after it was clear that Reagan had won, public opinion started to soften. And there were more and more voices speaking out saying, you have won, Mr. President. Take these people back if they admit the error of their ways. And you can penalize them monetarily for what they've done, et cetera. But let's not hurt the air traffic control system by banning them permanently, which will take us 5-10 years to fully recover from. Jack Kemp, Republican leader, made that argument. William Safire, the columnist in the New York Times, a conservative Republican, made that argument. There were people around Reagan who said, you've won. Let's declare victory. Let's avoid the spectacle of a mid-air collision that could maybe turn the tables and hurt us. And let's show mercy, because the public's starting to think you're kind of hard-hearted. It was at that moment, I think, that Reagan's decision really changed the course of things, because he was determined then not to change. He considered it. They had a meeting in the White House in December 1981. Leaders of the AFL-CIO, including Lane Kirkland, came and they sat with Reagan. I had the notes from the meeting that were taken by one of Reagan's top aides. They were almost verbatim. And they were poignant to read, because the labor people basically, by that point, begged. They said, this is no longer a union issue. This is an issue of families that are broken. There have been suicides. There have been people who've lost their homes. You have to remember, Mr. President, about air traffic controllers, that they are like almost no other workers in this country because there is only one employer for a skill that's taken them years to learn. If you're fired by the FAA and banned from returning, then a skill you've taken, in some cases, 5, maybe 10 years to fully master, you can't use it again, ever. Have mercy. Reagan, honestly, in that meeting, you could feel his pain in a sense because he didn't have the, I don't know, maybe you could say courage to say no. He wouldn't to their face say, no, I'm closing the door forever. He basically said, I'll think about it. In the meantime, I'm removing the ban. They can apply for jobs at the post office and in other parts of the federal government. The problem was there was a hiring freeze across federal government at that time, so it was kind of meaningless. But in the end, after the labor people left, Reagan sat down with his advisors and a memo which was circulated, written by his director of the Office of Personnel Management. And the guy laid out the options. And he basically said, Mr. President, you can take some of them back. Some people will like this if you do show mercy. But you need to consider this. And this is pretty much a verbatim quote. Other governments have been very impressed by your handling of this event. And you would lose something if you show a lack of resolve now. The one government they were most concerned with wasn't directly mentioned in the memo, but I'm sure you know it was the Soviet Union. And there, Reagan was really concerned about how the PATCO strike would be seen. And that, among other things, including a feeling I warned them, they still struck, led him to believe he was closing the door forever. It did send a powerful message. When Tip O'Neill went to the Soviet Union a couple of years later, Chris Matthews, who was then Tip O'Neill's aide, has recounted this. What the Kremlin leaders wanted to ask about was the PATCO strike. Because to them, it was evidence that Reagan was maybe crazy, that he was so rigid that he would put his whole presidency at risk. What if there had been an air disaster? And in a sense, you could say Reagan got what he wanted from making an example of PATCO in that way. But because he did what he did, I think the country has been changed. Think about it this way. There was no strike in American history that unfolded in every state and territory that was broken so publicly, where everybody saw it in real time, where everybody wondered, will he take any of them back? Could we even run a system without these skilled people? And he broke it. He broke it decisively. And by doing that, he sort of opened a new chapter. Because before that, it was really not so common for private sector employers to do what they legally could do. That is, they could fire people, or rather, when people went on strike, they could bring in replacement workers and just continue to run their plants. And as long as they were supposedly still in good faith, open the door to maybe talking with the union, they could just permanently, in effect, replace those workers. In strike, after PATCO, private sector employers followed the Reagan model and really permanently replaced people. As John points out, the paper workers were really hard hit, and he arrived there in 1986, just when the tidal wave was starting to swamp that union of strikes in Jay, Maine, Lockport, Pennsylvania, and elsewhere that were smashed one after another as replacement workers were brought in. The Hormel strike up in Minnesota. Many others, the Arizona copper miners strike. Since the breaking of PATCO, unions have been in sort of free fall. I wouldn't attribute it all to the PATCO strike. There were structural reasons that have hurt the labor movement. But the Patco strike had one devastating impact that no other structural thing had. And that was it took out of workers' hands, in effect, the power of collective action. And I think that more important than the decline in numbers of the past 20 years of union members in this country is the declining power of workers to be able to get management to a bargaining table and leverage that to the workers' benefit. Even where unions exist now in the private sector and we're down around 7%, they are weak and on the defensive. In the public sector, we now see that they're under assault. And over time, we've seen that the strike has almost disappeared from the United States. There were about 270 major strikes per year, measured by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, all through the 60s and 70s. By major, I mean involving at least 1,000 workers. Just a couple of years ago, the number was 5. American workers don't really have the power to use collective action anymore. And that's why in recent years, the labor movement's main tool has not been collective action, it's been political action. And here you see where the real toxic after effect of the Reagan era and of the Patco strike takes effect. Because what happened, in a sense, was this. Once Reagan broke Patco and then refused to take anybody back, he kind of made it a litmus test of conservatives to be that tough. And that's where we get the Scott Walkers of the world. Because after that, they pointed to that. These guys were wiped out. That's what being a conservative is about. There was a time when one could be a conservative without necessarily hating collective bargaining. That's not really true today. So they've become more anti-union. Just as labor has needed more and more to focus on political action to get anything done for workers, and that's fed a kind of self-reinforcing cycle, because the labor movement has to engage more in politics, finding the parties pulling apart on collective bargaining. There used to be some bipartisanship there. No more. Recent years, Republicans have actually tried to defund, get rid of the National Labor Relations Board, in effect. As they pull apart, the labor movement enters the political field trying to get through politics what it used to be able to get at the bargaining table, and more division emerges. And that's where we are today. And it's a sad state for us to be in this country, because as everybody I think here knows, what we've seen happen over the past 25 years, 35 years, to inequality in this country is staggering. We're more unequal now as a society than we've been since before the Great Depression, since the early 20th century. And politically, we have no ability to try to deal with that inequality. And workers certainly don't have the power, it seems right now, to deal with it. And I think that's the sad coda to the Patco strike, and one of the reasons why it continues to resonate even to this very day, 31 years later. So it's not a happy story, but I think it's a story that we need to engage and talk about. So thanks for letting me share it with you. Love to talk to you and have your questions.
Simon, please share your first question.
Jim?
Yeah. No, I thought I saw your hand up. Start with the first.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was Patco getting any advice and help from, say, the AFL-CIO Council or anything like that? I mean, just in the sense of informal advice on, you know, tactics, because I think everybody knew that was a fairly critical situation and period. Then the observation is this. I went out to the Lansing Airport and demonstrated in favor of Patco.
Mm-hmm.
Civil War pickets charge up a ski field and got lost. That's my
In a second, we'll let Rick maybe speak to that too. I try to convey the Patco story as accurately as I can, but to resist trying to be judgmental. So I never say it's a Pickett's charge. In fact, I think to really deal with this event, we have to get away from trying to judge and more trying to understand. I think retrospectively, you'd have to say it was probably ill-advised to strike. But you also have to say, why did they do it? And it's important for us to figure that out too. Now, to your other question, which has to do with Patco's relationship to the rest of the labor movement. No, there was really no talk between Patco leaders and the AFL-CIO in the summer of 1981. I think there was negligence on both sides of that. But I would say one thing about Patco and air traffic controllers, and maybe Rick can modify or even contradict what I say about this. I think air traffic controllers are unusual people. And they did an unusual job, because what they did really separated themselves from everybody else. I mean, separation is the hallmark of what they do, separating planes. But they were also separated, because when you do that work, you live in a bubble. It's stressful work. It was work on shifts that were constantly rotating, so you were out of sync with just about everybody else except your fellow workers. You were working often in very hothouse, tension-filled places. There was immense solidarity there. And so for the folks involved in this movement, it was hard for them to really understand the what you might call the civilian population or the rest of the labor movement, because they were in what it was to be an air traffic controller and a Patco member. And so that was the thing. Rick?
It was so different from what it is now.
Yeah, it's so different now than what it was then, because of the updated technology and flow control. The computers tell airplanes when they can take off. So you never get all the work. When I was in Detroit Metro and I came there with only a year and a half experience as a controller, and I was one of two controllers that had non-radar approach control experience, and we used to use the radar, lose our complete radar about once or twice a month with no idea when it would be back up. And when that happened, we had to go to non-radar separation, and there were two of us out of the 100 and some controllers there who would then get called in, and we'd be working approach control in a non-radar setting. What's even worse than losing your radar was losing your radios, and you could see the airplanes getting closer together and not have any ability to talk to them. We used equipment that had test tubes or tubes in them, like the old radios, and those tubes would go out on a regular basis. So losing your radios is even worse than losing the radar, because you knew how to separate with non-radar approach. When I first got there, we had so short staffed, we were using trainees in the tower alone. And in the radar room, we had coffee cans, because you didn't always get a break when you needed to go to the bathroom. So people took a piss while they were working track.
Right.
That's how bad it was. Yeah. 3 years in a row, we were the most systems errors in the country at Detroit Metro. Mm. And to get checked out there, you had to be able to handle every airplane they threw at you. And we had all this nice airspace divided up into flow in, flow out, and you're supposed to use that. To get checked out, you had to allow everybody who had a request to go through there to go through, and you had to work around them. So there were many times when you got up from working traffic and you're absolutely soaked with sweat. And then they turned around and we had a 25-year out in retirement.
Mm-hmm.
One person before I, while I was there in six years, one person retired under that. Every single person that left was either a washout, because they weren't good enough to make it, which is about 3/4 of those who started, or else they had medical complications. And these were people that came into the air traffic at a very young age, because they were in the military at 18 and got out 3-4 years later, 22, they could not make it to 47. When you turned 39, you were on your way down as being sharp as a controller.
Mm-hmm.
That's how devastating it was on people. So that, to me, that was the biggest reason that people voted to go out on strike. I personally voted against it. Then I was prosecuted, one of the 4 or 5 guys that were prosecuted in Detroit. And that's what led me to say, I might go to law school then.
Right.
And Reagan in the Rose Garden,
yeah,
this, on August 3, he was asked a question about, are they banned for life? And
yeah,
he said, and I used this in my, I filed a lawsuit to try to get hired, rehired after 3 years. There's a federal regulation that says after mm-hmm. 3 years, anybody who's been terminated,
right,
they must conduct, OPM must conduct a suitability determination. And they, the government said, Ronald Reagan modified that federal regulation. Well, that's not proper under the separation of powers within the U.S. Constitution. When I got with, done with my argument in the U.S. Court of Appeals for Federal Circuit, the judges were expecting the government to get up and make their argument, and they told the attorney for the government, that's all right, you don't need to make your argument. We've heard enough, you don't need to make it. We got down and walked out with him. He says, you know what, where this is going, you're going to lose that case. I said, I understand it. He said, but between me and you, says, you should win. You have constitutional arguments, should have won.
Mm-hmm.
But then I got a job, didn't have a chance to appeal beyond there. So.
Right. There's several other people I know who went into law careers too, so, yes. You know, it's a good question. I tell the story in the book of the morning of the strike, August 3rd. It actually happened to be the same morning that the Executive Council of the AFL-CIO was meeting in Chicago. So Lane Kirkland was chairing a meeting, including all of the leaders of the unions, Doug Frazier, the auto workers, for example. J.J. O'Donnell, who was the head of the Airline Pilots Association. William Wimpensinger, Wimpy, who's the head of the Machinists Union. You know, to the question of did the AFL-CIO properly read what was going on, you know, I describe what happened in that meeting when Kirkland announced just as they were opening in the morning that PATCO was on strike. There was a lot of consternation in the room. Kirkland went first to J.J. O'Donnell, he's the head of the pilots, and said, J.J., what do you think? J.J. said, that's an illegal strike. My members are opposed to it. If I tried to get them to respect a picket line, they would throw me out in 2 minutes. They feel that this strike is taking bread out of their mouths because it's going to shut down airlines. There's no way we can support this strike. Kirkland turned to William Wimpensinger, whose members maintained the engines on the nation's fleet of airliners, and said, Wimpy, what do you think? And Wimpy said, we must stand up to Reagan. We cannot allow him to break this union movement. If you remember Wimpy, he was a pretty militant in his rhetoric. He was a socialist, and you know, he was no friend of Reagan's, and he spoke really about strongly standing up to Reagan. The labor movement has to come together. We have to stand up. But he was noticeably stopping short. He never said, my members will stay out in solidarity and bring the airlines to a grinding halt. He didn't do that. Later on, a week later, he was at his own union's executive council meeting, and I read the minutes of that meeting. And there was no support within the machinists for it. And part of it went to, that is for PATCO, that it, part of it went to what PATCO's demands were. And PATCO made a, what you'd have to say was a serious error in framing its demands, because it put out almost front and center a demand for across the board $10,000 wage increase. Now, the union really never believed it would get that. But framing the increase was meant to send a certain message. We are not going to take a couple pennies. We want something significant. But that's what was out in the public. Everybody knew $10,000. Both the AFL-CIO, PATCO's own records, the airline pilots' records are flooded with letters from union members saying, screw PATCO. $10,000. We just gone through a negotiation where we've given givebacks. So there was not, I think, to answer your question, there was not a sufficient degree of support or solidarity within the labor movement. So no matter what the union heads had wanted to do, their judgment was if we try to stand up toe-to-toe with Reagan and call a national, you know, general strike, we're going to lose. They saw those first public opinion polls, and they were enormously supportive of Reagan. So, question.
Yeah. You said Reagan was just sort of like a nice guy.
No. I'm not saying he's a nice guy.
The thing is, look who we put in charge of the FAA.
Right, Lynn Helms. But
yeah,
but Helms was not allowed to do any of the negotiating.
His road to glory.
Right, right.
Was firing all the people with Piper Aircraft.
Absolutely. He hated unions.
We're talking about, you know, an anti-union person right there.
Absolutely.
And you're talking about Drew Lewis.
Yeah.
His claim to fame was busting the union for the shipping companies.
You know,
Yeah,
but the facts are what they are. And the facts are that what Reagan put on the table was what he put on the table.
But people leave that out. You know,
I don't leave it out.
And when you see them talking about that $10,000 pay raise,
yeah,
it goes into a negotiation and asking,
of course.
Really,
that's right.
Of
course. Of course. That's right.
You know, maybe a trip to the corner.
But then you have to understand how, if you do that, how that can be, in effect, a chain you've welded around yourself. And that's what happened. So, yeah, of course, that's true. You know, I don't think so.
I do.
I think they played the media well.
I was one of them. He may not have voted for this, right? I did.
Okay, but I think that, you know, okay, where were you, by the way? Where were you working? Okay. You know, I think if you read this book, I don't think you'll disagree with it.
Well,
because
the book that I like reading better than any other book was one by Ebbing Bowers.
Yeah, yeah. It was the study of the FAA's practices that led to the strike. And I totally agree with it. And what that book says and what I also argue is that this strike wouldn't have happened if the FAA had been decent employers. That's what Bowers argued. And that's what I've said.
But I sat there, you know, and the animosity towards air traffic controllers,
right,
was just overwhelming. I was a bartender here in
Yeah, right.
The guy, when he found out I was an ex-air traffic controller, he fired me.
Right. But you
now,
have...
I went to law school.
Mm-hmm, good.
Right. And I was applying for jobs. I sent my application. Some guy called me down in Detroit. I wanted, you know, for an interview. I walked into the interview, and then son of a bitch sits there and looks at me and says, "We're not hiring you. I just want to see what a fire air traffic controller would look like."
I heard,
yeah.
Look, I think what was done to you was dead wrong. And in fact, I've heard many, many stories like this where there was absolute cruelty against you guys. So I think that I totally agree with you. I totally agree with you. I think, though, it's a mistake to say that it's only that Reagan better played the media, because what that leaves out is why so many workers lacked solidarity with you guys. And we need to understand that.
We turned it down. We essentially were told, says they, nobody else can strike with us. We can't depend on them. It'd be an illegal secondary boycott if they did. We don't want them. Now, when things started going bad, we changed our view and tried to get them to come in on board.
Right.
But in the beginning, that's what the word was coming through.
I don't either.
If they had stopped with the controller, mm-hmm, we wouldn't be having a problem.
Well, on that I have to say this. I think that if the AFL-CIO had tried to stand with PATCO, it would have seen its own members say, you know, screw you, I'm not going to do it. Who was it?
It was a UAW.
I know, right.
It was the Teamsters, it was everyone.
Well, here's what Doug Fraser. I know. This is what. Right. I talked to Doug Frazier. Okay, I talked to Doug Frazier, who headed the UAW then. He said he was on picket lines in Lansing, in Detroit. And he said, you know, I just. Okay. Well, maybe it wasn't Lansing. But what he said was that, you know, I couldn't get my members to support this. That I felt bad for those guys because they found themselves in a trap after 48 hours and they couldn't get out of it. But I could not get auto workers to come out because what I'm going through in the UAW at the very same time are concession contracts. So I think you make an important point. And I think what Reagan did was wrong. But in what way? What?
I tried to go back here.
You did?
After 12.
After 12?
Yes.
What happened? I've heard this, by the way, from others, so go ahead.
I called the facility. Right. I kept giving them the busy signal.
Right.
And I wanted to find out exactly when I should report to work. And I went in, they wouldn't let me in the facility.
I've heard that before.
And wouldn't answer my calls. I ended up suing the FAA. They said, they get the secretary up there. They said, well, he tried to call, but there was a busy signal. And the secretary said, yeah, that's probably true because we took the phone call.
Right.
So,
well,
they're talking about, yeah. 48 hours. That 40 hours is non-existent.
For many people, that was true.
Right.
Right. Right.
Well,
let me just say one thing about that. That is about 1,500 people did return. For some people, they were able to return. I've heard others who ran into what you ran into, and they were not allowed in. And that speaks to something, I think, that really helped cause the strike. What I say in the book is in the hours going up to the negotiation, the FAA almost did all in its power in some of its local facility chiefs to antagonize controllers because they wanted to get them to walk out so that they could get rid of people they didn't like, maybe like yourself. So I'm not surprised to hear that.
Let me throw out one thing. Just, being in solidarity in 1981 was one of the most exhilarating moments of my life. Nearly 2.5 quite the bit.
It was the most moving event I've ever been. They had us walk through the entire crowd from the back, through everybody up in the front, making it hard for those to come to sit.
Well, I want to thank our two air traffic controllers. I want to thank Dr. McCartan. It's been a wonderful presentation. Thank you all for coming. Do make sure that you sign in if you haven't signed in or sign sheet. And we'll see you next Friday for Tom Marvin at Occupy the University. Thank you so much.
Thank you.